A publishing giant finds one solution to the business challenge of self-publishing authors. Meanwhile, just in time for Olympics gymnastics, an industry tally of book sales in 2011 shows a business in the midst of a backflip. In reviews, we learn about another difficult trick, how to turn Bluebeard, the notorious wife murderer, into a romantic hero. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally, the host of Beyond the Book, and every Friday, we turn to the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the latest news in books and a view ahead to what will have the business buzzing next week. Joining me, as he regularly does, is Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
It's good to have you join us, and we have had a week full of interesting numbers to report. Tell us about those.
Yeah, that's right. So this week saw the release of the Bookstats Report, which is the annual industry sales survey that's coordinated by the Association of American Publishers and the Book Industry Study Group. And this year's edition had a bit of that bad news, good news thing going on. The bad news first, total book sales fell 2.5% in 2011 to $27.2 billion, that is. The good news, however, is that unit sales actually rose. In fact, they rose a healthy 3.4% to 2.77 billion units. So what does that mean? Well, the discrepancy in part is due to higher sales of lower priced ebooks and also books, of course. And, you know, and that makes total sense given the changes that we've seen in the supply side in recent years, from, you know, digital delivery of ebooks to better warehouse and distribution and online ordering systems. I mean, you would expect prices of books to fall given what we've seen on the supply side. But the real takeaway for me here is that for all the hand-wringing about the health of reading in the digital age, with so many more options, games and videos and movies and all this kind of stuff, people are reading more. We're consuming more books. And that is undoubtedly awesome news. You know, for all the difficulty that we're facing in the current market transition, what's hitting book selling, what's hitting publishing, the fact that people are reading more books is something to build on for sure. There is indeed, I believe, greater demand than ever for the product of reading.
Well, you know, Andrew, I have to say, I love your enthusiasm and your positive spin, but let's dig down a little bit further into those numbers and look for the good news, but as you mentioned at the top, some of the bad news as well. And of course, ebooks factor into all of that.
Big time, you know, and no surprise here, ebooks are pretty much the major part of the story. You know, in the trade segment, sales of ebooks more than doubled, rising to $2.07 billion, up from $869 million in 2010. You know, think about that for a second. All we're looking at the day when ebooks would surpass $1 billion in sale. Well, from the last survey to this one, it blew past $2 billion in sales. That's a pretty incredible moment. Unit sales, meanwhile, increased 210% to 388 million. In fact, ebook growth sales offset the decline in print, which brings the total sales in the trade book segments up slightly. You know, overall book sales were actually up about 0.5% this year because ebooks were up so much. The ebook growth is pretty astonishing. On its own. Ebooks now account for 15% of all trade sales in 2011. That's more than double from the 6% in 2010. Ebook sales in adult fiction increased 117% to $1.27 billion. And that now represents 30% of that segment's sales. And that makes ebooks the largest single format within adult fiction, surpassing hardcovers, trade paperbacks, and the mass market paperback formats. You know, think about that for a second now. Ebooks roughly account for a third of all trade book sales. And that segment, ebooks, is still posting triple digit growth year over year. So it's, you know, incredible, going to be incredible to watch in the coming years. Now, you mentioned the good news, bad news thing. The impact of ebooks can also be seen on the bookselling community. You know, sales via online booksellers jumped 35%. They hit more than $5 billion last year. That's good news. Sales through bricks and mortar stores fell 12.6% last year to $8.59 billion. You know, and here's another wrinkle that caught my eye. Bookstats also reported that direct-to-consumer sales for trade houses rose 57% last year, and publishers are now selling direct-to-consumers over $1 billion a year worth of books. Now, publishers are not retailers. They're not out there with big retail operations, obviously, to sell books. But nevertheless, they're finding some success in selling them. And I think that's a very interesting number to consider, especially, you know, given the wide open future now facing the industry. We're going to have a lot more on the book report stat in Monday's issue, so you'll definitely want to check that out.
Well, you know, obviously these are numbers about what's happening with publishers, but the story of 2012 has to be self-publishing, and now we've got a story that brings self-publishing and publishers a lot closer together, and that really looks to the future. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely, and we'll certainly be following this up on this in next week's issue as well. You know, I mentioned the wide open future. Well, there was a big deal in the publishing community this week. You know, and I've been saying it for a while, and I'll say it again, and you've said it too. Self-publishing has arrived. Indeed, this week, Pearson, the parent company of Penguin, acquired Author Solutions, one of the largest self-publishing ventures in the world. They paid $116 million. And in a conference call, Penguin CEO John Makinson and Author Solutions CEO Kevin Weiss said that the deal marked the mainstreaming of self-publishing, and I couldn't agree more. So this is really a pretty big deal. You know, you'll remember last year that Penguin created its own self-publishing community. I think it was called Book Country. Well, they've now added this self-publishing firm that has 1,600 employees, revenues of just under $100 million in 2011, and nearly 200,000 books published by 150,000 authors in print and in ebook formats. You know, Makinson, on the announcement of the deal, said that Penguin had been looking at the self-publishing market with, quote, growing respect and admiration. And he pointed to the success of self-published writers like E.L. James and Amanda Hocking. He said that self-publishing is growing and converging with traditional publishing. You know, and on the practical side, this puts Penguin in a great spot. You know, they now have the scalable data and expertise and greater opportunities for, you know, growth and wider distribution. But the real good news here is that Makinson said that Pearson is going to upsize that operation, not downsize it. So many times when we see mergers of companies, you know, they integrate them into the existing companies and you see people laid off. Well, not this time. Makinson says they're actually going to grow the company and they're probably going to be hiring more in the coming years. So we'll have a lot more on this issue next week. But I just want to point out another reason why I love this move. Because I think it shows this time that the publishing industry is answering the bell. You know, when it comes to change, the book business, in my opinion, has a history of kind of ceding the innovation to other players as they come into the market. You know, look no further than the ebook business if you doubt that's true, right? But as self-publishing now is showing its potential and it's still pretty early in the game, this is a move by a major house that says, we're in.
That's right. And, you know, it wouldn't be a week talking to Andrew Albanese if we didn't at least take a quick visit to court. Tell us what you've seen there.
Yeah. So this today, actually, I believe we're going to see filings in the Authors Guild and Hathi Trust suits, the oppositions to the summary judgment motion. So that should be very interesting to see what the arguments reveal there. And also, we're going to finally, hopefully, see the comments in the Department of Justice antitrust settlement. One party note on the DOJ in the Wall Street Journal this week, Senator Charles Schumer from New York got involved. He penned a really great editorial. And what's important about this is that Schumer did not call for the settlement to be rejected. He called for the DOJ to drop the suit entirely. He hits the nail on the head. And let's hope that that point of view gains some traction in the government.
Well, it's certainly fascinating times in a campaign year when the book business gets its space on the op-ed page. So thank you for that, Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor. And I want to turn, as we usually do, we have Rose Fox back with us. She blogs at Genreville for PW and is the science fiction, fantasy, horror, and romance reviews editor. Rose, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Thank you, Chris. I missed you.
Oh, well, we missed you too, but we knew it is July, so time for a little bit of R&R.
Absolutely.
And I don't know where you were, but this week the fiction section goes northwest and southwest.
Yeah, in fiction this week, we cover Blasphemy, New and Selected Stories by Sherman Alexie. I'd be surprised if anyone listening doesn't know who he is, but if you don't, he's the National Book Award winner, Penn Faulkner Award winner, and he's written a great many wonderful books about what it means to be a Native American and in present-day America. And this collection has 15 classic stories, including The Toughest Indian in the World, Salt and Indian Education, along with 15 recent stories of varying length and tenor. Our reviewer says the result is gangbusters, and it should both attract new fans and invite back longtime fans. We also cover, moving to the Southwest, With Blood in Their Eyes by Thomas Cobb is a gripping 20th century century Western presents a fictionalized account of the bloodiest shootout in Arizona history and the desperate manhunt that ensued in the rugged mountains and arid deserts of 1918 Arizona. And Cobb masterfully creates a tale of crooked lawmen, whiskey smugglers, cowboys, and gold miners, while also illuminating the very real tension in the area between Mormons and Gentiles. So the PW reviewer says that Cobb's vivid descriptions of these wounded outlaws and expert visceral suspense make this one of the best Westerns of the year.
Wow, you know, and I think we should point out, given what's happening otherwise, is this is published by the University of Arizona.
I think you usually think of university presses as doing like a lot of sort of ponderous nonfiction, and it's actually really cool to see a university press pulling out a suspenseful Western.
And what we learned from PW is that the author is represented by ICM, so we might see a movie out of that.
Oh, anything's possible.
Indeed. What else are you covering this week?
We have two books by the late Serbian writer Danilo Kis, who died in 1918. It's a novel and a collection, and our reviewer doesn't love the novel, Psalm 44, but the review of the short stories in The Lute and the Scars says they are vigorously inventive. And we have a fiction Q&A with Dean Kuntz. There's another writer who tends to transcend genre. He talks about integrating his spiritual beliefs into his work and says, "The world is an amazing place full of more beauty than many people bother to see, and in the complexity of that beauty is meaning."
In Mysteries and Thrillers, H.G. Wells makes an appearance.
We have a book by Spanish author Felix J. Palma, and he used The Time Machine by H.G. Wells as the starting point for his novel, The Map of Time. And this one is called The Map of the Sky, which is based on The War of the Worlds. He investigates the possibility that Martians actually landed on Earth years before The War of the Worlds came out. And our reviewer says that fans of intelligent science fiction, as well as historical thrillers, will be rewarded. And in Canadian author Linwood Barclay's tantalizing standalone Trust Your Eyes, a schizophrenic who's a map-obsessed savant witnesses what appears to be a murder on Manhattan's Lower East Side while looking at a website. When he asks his older brother, who's a reporter, for help, the brothers soon find themselves in the fight for their lives with some dangerous criminals. The engaging characters grab your heart, even as the plot makes it stop. And we have a Q&A with Michael Sears. He's the debut author of Black Fridays, a financial thriller. He talks about wrongdoing on Wall Street and says people who work on Wall Street are there to make money. They're not altruists. But most of them resist the temptation to cheat. And he wanted readers to see just how easy it is to slip. Science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we have some interesting first steps in urban fantasy. The first is Clean by Alex Hughes. That's a debut that started out as a submission to Amazon's Breakthrough Novel Award contest. After it was a semifinalist, it was picked up by Penguin's Rock imprint, and it stars a drug-addicted telepath who solves mysteries in a future Atlanta battled by the devastating tech wars. Our reviewer says this crisp debut marks Hughes as a writer to watch. We also cover The Dirty Streets of Heaven. This is the first noir fantasy from Tad Williams, who's known as an epic fantasist. He's been writing in that genre for many, many years. And this one stars Bobby Dollar, who's an earthbound angel who advocates for the nearly departed. He's appalled when a soul goes missing, and he sets out to find the lost soul amid the chaos of heaven and hell's wrangling and human wrongdoing. And we think readers are going to love Bobby's gutsiness, determination, and offbeat sense of humor. In romance, we have the novel that you mentioned in our intro. Christine Grayson's Charming Blue pulls off the difficult trick of turning Bluebeard, who obviously is best known for killing his wives, into a romantic hero. In her version of the story, the notorious killer is actually cursed, and anyone who loves him dies horribly. Naturally, he deals with this by drinking himself into a stupor. Then a man claiming to be Bluebeard begins threatening women, and a lovely magical investigator shows up on Blue's doorstep to clear his name. It's really a great, interesting, unusual premise, and it leads to a terrific blend of mystery and romantic tension. And we have a review of Joe Goodman's The Last Renegade. We're back to the West again. This is a historical romance set in 1888 Wyoming, in which a traveler and a saloon owner take on a fascinating cast of multidimensional villains who are trying to consolidate their hold over a small town. And Goodman adds humor and drama to what the Publisher's Weekly reviewer calls a complicated, fast-paced, and deliciously believable story of love, sex, and secrets.
Well, we now turn to nonfiction, Rose, and Naomi Wolf, well-known indeed, comes in for a Q&A.
Yeah, see, I love that you leave it up to me to name her new book. It's Vagina, a New Biography. And in her Q&A with us, she says, "You could write this book with all kinds of other titles, but there is something important to me about just reclaiming that word." And I think we can expect a lot of traffic and a lot of conversation around this book, though people may be reluctant to say the title. Also in nonfiction, Joseph Epstein, who's the former editor of American Scholar and the author of Gossip, The Untrivial Pursuit, brings an erudite gift for portraiture to the subjects of 40 essays. The book is called Essays in Biography. It's focused primarily on figures from the 19th and 20th century, with occasional excursions into Greek antiquity and colonial America. And Epstein offers eloquent assessments of philosophers, politicians, athletes, composers, social scientists, movie stars, and especially writers and critics. The essays are opinionated, sometimes personal, edifying, and often very entertaining. And there's a particularly interesting piece about Saul Bellow, with whom Epstein had a big falling out. In the striking collection Violentology, a manual of the Colombian conflict, award-winning photojournalist Stephen Ferry follows his 1999 meditation on tin miners in Bolivia with this equally unblinking portrait of human struggle. It's shot over more than a decade and full of images that form a raw, arresting look at Colombia's longstanding internal conflict, launched by the cocaine trade, but now infinitely more complex. And the breadth of this excellent collection accentuates an unwieldy and horrific topic, but one that is profoundly important. At a time when the role of the Supreme Court is again in the headlines, as Andrew was talking about a little bit earlier, following the ruling upholding Obamacare, Harvard Law's Michael Klarman does a remarkable job using the debate over same-sex marriage as a lens for examining the factors that will go into the court's inevitable engagement with the issue. The book is called From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. And Klarman effectively conveys the history of the issue from the 1950s to 2012. It provides just enough detail to allow lay readers to emerge with an informed understanding of the twisted path same-sex marriage has taken. And his last book was called From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Racial Equality. So it's clear this is someone who knows how to research such a topic.
Well, you know, Rose, I have to say, here's a word I don't mind saying. In the children's section, it's Ninja Week in picture books.
That's right. We review Nighttime Ninja, which is illustrated by Ed Young, and also The Three Ninja Pigs, illustrated by Dan Santat. We also have a neat tribute to Jack Kerouac called Hit the Road, Jack, which is illustrated by Ross McDonald. On the fiction side of the children's section, we have new books from Jerry Spinelli, Third Grade Angels, James Patterson's Confessions of a Murder Suspect, and Michelle Paver's Gods and Warriors. And we have two roundups, one on math-themed books, the other on dinosaurs, which are a perennial topic among children. In the online annex, featuring short fiction, essays, poetry, and photography, is My Postwar Life, New Writings from Japan and Okinawa. This is a stunning testament to a country's literal rise from the ashes. Casual readers and academics alike will find many of these selections rewarding and informative. And also, Ryan Holiday, the director of marketing for American Apparel, divulges the tricks of the trade in the provocative Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. He admits to being no media scholar, but he convincingly maps the new media landscape of blogs and DIY publicity, as well as cataloging some of his own exploits, like defacing his own billboards to build street-level buzz for infamous internet personality Tucker Max. So media students and bloggers, take heed. Holiday does seem to know what he's talking about.
Well, that's an intriguing title. And finally, for the pick of the week, Rose Fox, the description of this just befuddles me. It's another one of those steampunk novels, this one set in Japan.
Well, it's set in a place that's like Japan. The book is Storm Dancer by Jay Kristoff. We highlighted this as a title to watch out for in our fall announcements issue, and I was really pleased to get in this review that says it's everything it's cracked up to be. The idea is that in this very Japan-like country, there is an industrial revolution going on, and blood lotus plants create the fuel for sky ships, but they also poison the air with the fumes from the fuel, and their roots create areas of ground where nothing else can grow. So a 16-year-old girl and a wounded thunder tiger, maybe better known to Westerners as a griffin, are trapped in this last wilderness in the country and must ultimately confront the full might of the insane shogun who is determined to continue progress at any cost. PW's reviewer says the innovative setting, fast-moving plot, vivid descriptions, and thrilling action scenes make this a refreshing, enjoyable addition to the steampunk canon. Did that make it any clearer?
Well, I was going to say steampunk canon. One of these days, Rose, we can do a whole episode on the steampunk canon. We really appreciate your helping us understand that fascinating genre. Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville, thanks so much for the review of the reviews.
Anytime.
We should tell people, as we always do, that Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.